The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to The History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme...
The human impact of these incidents has to be included in a rounded understanding of that overall conflict.
These guys, the auxiliaries, were going to take the war to the IRA.
As we continue our series on the Irish War of Independence, we look in detail at the Dirty War.
His body was very much charred and was all scars and gashes.
I actually discovered this years ago from military archives and I actually couldn't believe what I was reading.
This is the first of two episodes exploring the attacks and reprisals that came to define the conflict.
He didn't want to send in the army. Mr. Lloyd George was keen to keep Ireland what he called a police war.
We'll ask, who were the auxiliaries and the Black and Tans? And we'll investigate some of the war's most infamous atrocities. I'll be joined throughout this programme by four guests. Paul O'Brien is a military historian and author. Ernest McCall is a researcher and author who's written three books about the auxiliaries. Liz Gillis is an historian and author. And Dr. Tomás McNamara is an oral historian and author. You're all very welcome indeed. The parallel efforts of the breakaway Sinn Féin government and the military campaign ruthlessly prosecuted by the IRA aimed to break the British will to rule Ireland. In 1920, as the conflict gathered pace, the British government responded with two new forces, the Black and Tans and the Auxiliaries. We'll start with the Tans, as they were the first to arrive in March of 1920. Tomás, your book, The Time of the Tans, was published earlier this year. In it, you look at how the Black and Tans are remembered in County Clare, specifically by people who were alive at the time and also by people who inherited memories that were passed down through the generations. In your work as an oral historian, you've interviewed many people who had first-hand experience of the Tans and Auxies. What was it like for you, first of all, to hear those stories and to react to those stories?
Sure. Well, firstly, I started hearing those stories as a very young boy in my townland in East Clare. And when I got into my teenage years, I started to read much more when I got interested in the War of Independence. And I started to realise fairly quickly that there was a significant enough difference between what I was reading in the literature in terms of an account of that time and what I was actually hearing at a local level. So it struck me that there was something missing there that, you know, could be bridged by the documentation of memory. And just instinctively as a young teenager, I started writing down what I was hearing from people and then started recording it at about the age of 18. But it really, over time, has strengthened in my view as an oral historian the need for the documentation of that local experience, because there's one thing providing an account with statistical evidence as to what happened during that time. But when you actually employ oral history and memory, you get the broader experience. And in relation to the Black and Tans, my book is called The Time of the Tans, and that's a conscious reference to the period of time as much as to the force. And I think that's actually a critical point, because we know there was the Black and Tans, we know there was the RIC, we know there was the auxiliaries, we know there was the regular army. But that whole period is categorised as the Time of the Tans, and because in memory, the Black and Tans seem to elevate as the principal guilty party.
It's also known as the Tan War.
Exactly.
This is the Tan War. Now, we're going to hear from some of the people that you interviewed. Tell us a little bit, first of all, who was Nora Canavan?
Yeah, Nora Canavan was 108 years of age when she passed away as, you know, Ireland, well, the oldest woman in Ireland. There was a woman, an East Clare woman, actually, in America, older than her, would you believe it? But I interviewed Nora a number of times over my years of research. She was 12 years of age during the War of Independence when an ambush happened right outside her door. She remembered the Monreal ambush, which was close to her house in December 1920. But equally, she remembered the entire experience. And what I say about Nora, and you'll hear it in the audio, is that in her breathing, you can actually hear the experience. Because sometimes you can get an account of that time or you can get evidence. But it actually, her body language when I recorded her, you know, you asked what it was like to hear it. She's probably one of the prime examples that when you're sitting in front of somebody, the body language takes on part of the narration, you know, when she's recalling the fear, the trauma. Now, she was part of a family that weren't directly connected to the conflict. Her father suffered during the conflict, but wasn't an IRA volunteer. So she actually is a really important person to capture that experience. And as I say, at the age of 104, you'll hear her recounting her experience of that time.
OK, let's hear an excerpt from your interview, one of your interviews with Nora Canavan, who describes the fear that was felt upon the arrival of the Tans.
The time of the Tans, it was an awful time. God, you wouldn't know the hour of the night. They'd knock on the door and they'd come in and search your house. And if there was a spark of light seen, The windows had to be barricaded, covered up, no light to be seen. Oh, you'd be afraid of your life, sure.
And she goes on to talk about a boy who was shot through a window.
Mm-hmm.
And that boy, the Murphys, we were talking of the last day, that was very sad. Wasn't it sitting down reading a book, as it was when he was shot through the window? Oh, God, it took an awful effect on them, did.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, she mentions Francie Murphy in her recollection, and in my research I would have interviewed a number of other people, including his nephew. Francie Murphy was a 15-year-old boy from a place called Glannon in Ennistymon. Now, he was shot in August 1919, so obviously it wasn't the Black and Tans, it wasn't the auxiliaries. The allegation is that it was British military. There had been two RIC constables had been killed in the area in the weeks previous to that. The British military had been very active and intimidating in the area after that, so there was an allegation. It is contested, it has to be said. There is a further suggestion that it was a land issue. But the evidence would point in the military's direction. But in either case, a 15-year-old boy was reading by the fire on the night of the 15th of August 1919 and is shot through the window. His sister, Una, runs to his aid, is there when he dies. And in my connection to it in terms of, or my most powerful connection in terms of memory, is recording his nephew, Una's son, in 2011. And him recalling that in 1965, he's beside his mother, Una, in Ennistymon Hospital. She's in her second day of a coma. She manages to come out of the coma, sits forward in the bed, pulls the crucifix from behind her in the bed, kisses the crucifix, looks to the foot of the bed and says, "Francie, Francie, Francie," lies back down, goes back into a coma and dies the following day. They were her last three words, and it was the first time in 46 years that she had spoken about her brother, Francie Murphy. So again, for me, what that really underlined was the role of silence when you're exploring memory and the human impact of these incidents that have to be included in a rounded understanding of that overall conflict.
Now, the Tans, as we said, had a good head start. They arrived in March in 1920, a good head start over the auxiliaries. Did it take long for their presence to be felt in County Clare?
No, as in other areas, certainly not. I mean, it was more of a behavioural thing, I think, in the earlier period. It was really until the summer of 1920 when both sides escalate the conflict, certainly in County Clare. But at a behavioural level, in terms of the raids that were taking place, there was a discernible difference after the arrival of the Black and Tans. And that actually has a really significant impact in terms of the attitudes of people, because even though there was plenty tension and conflict prior to the arrival of the Black and Tans, it has now taken on another bitter dimension, and that does impact. Dozens and dozens of people testified to me that after they arrived at the Black and Tans, and because of their behaviour, that hardened the attitudes of people. And if we see from March to July 1920, certainly in County Clare, we see a dramatic escalation of the violent nature of the conflict, and we enter into a really violent period then.
We'll hear another extract now from one of your recordings. You're interviewing Michael O'Gorman, who talks about what happened to his grandfather and granduncle when they ran into a patrol of Tans.
Beat up my grandfather and my granduncle, Michael. Michael was his brother-in-law.
That's Michael Young, isn't
Michael
it?
Young, yeah. When they were coming home, they were coming up the Fecal Road, they're near my commitments. The Tans were actually on their way down the Fecal Road. They struck my grandfather into the face with a butt of a rifle and smashed his jaw. And I hammered him and kicked him while he was on the ground. But Michael tried to help him, and I struck Michael with the butt of a rifle. And when Michael fell, one of them stood on him. It stood on his arm, and another stood on his back. And he got the butt of the rifle and smashed his arm again and again and again with the butt of the rifle.
Michael O'Gorman speaking there to Thomas McNamara, and that's another example of the powerful testimony that highlights the value of oral history recordings. Ernest, the Tans and the auxiliaries, they're essentially supplementary forces.
Yes.
Assisting the Royal Irish Constabulary. So the Tans have arrived in March 1920. Why was it felt necessary to introduce the auxiliaries several months later? And who were the auxiliaries?
Well, basically, the British government realised that the Black and Tans weren't solving the problem. So they thought that they would need another bit of help. And the auxiliaries were originally going to be an officer class of the Black and Tans. But in a fluid situation, things don't always go as planned. And when they arrived, they were realised that with the experience and the knowledge of these new auxiliaries coming in, who were all ex-officers from the three services plus the Merchant Marine, you believe, and roughly about 10% of them had come with bravery awards from the First War. You had three Victoria Crosses, 175 military crosses, 55 military medals, and numerous other awards from the British, as well as French, Belgian and Americans. And during their time in Ireland, eight of these members of the Auxiliary Division win the Constabulary Medal, which is the highest bravery award in the RIC at that time. So you're bringing in good quality manpower. So they were then formed into companies and sent to the most dangerous parts of the island. So yeah, the makeup of the division was, you would believe, men from the US, United States, England, Scotland, Ireland, Wales, Australia, New Zealand.
So there were Americans in
yes,
the auxiliary.
Yes, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, South Africa, and one man from Burma, who happened to be a Englishman who was a police superintendent out in Burma, home on leave in London, seen the advert for the division, applied for it, got it. Whenever he came over, he did his time in Ireland. When the partition happened, he went back to Burma.
Now, they were known as Tudor's Toughs, and
yes,
they liked to call themselves the Toughs. We
yes,
call them the Oxies. Who was Tudor?
Tudor was the Inspector General of the RIC, or the main police officer for the whole of the country. He also covered the Dublin Metropolitan Police. He was the main police officer for the entire country.
Paul, you've also written about the auxiliaries in your 2017 book, Havoc. You examine the role they played in the war. How would you characterise them?
I think it's actually quite interesting because we're calling this a war. We've mentioned earlier the Tan War, the Irish War of Independence. This is actually an insurgency, and the British government were taken very unawares by this. The Black and Tans were brought in to bolster up the Royal Irish Constabulary, who were at front line actually, and they suffered very, very heavy casualties from 1919 onwards, and they would be the one who would have really taken the brunt.
And this is a paramilitary police force fighting what you would characterise as an insurgency.
The Black and Tans weren't doing the job, and Winston Churchill, who actually came up with the idea for the auxiliaries, wanted they were called like a special gendarmerie, but he had something more in mind for this. These guys, the auxiliaries, were going to take the war to the IRA. That instead of being holed up in a barracks with barbed wire and machine guns and be surrounded, they were actually going to go out and bring this fight. So they were actually going to launch a counter-insurgency campaign. And that's what happened in the late summer of 1920. And these guys, all their units, their companies, all came into Dublin, then spread out all over the country. And they were sent to every trouble spot in the country. And I believe, from my research, that they were the forerunner of, say, let's say, the SAS, the Special Air Service, or the Royal Marine Commandos. This was a special forces unit of its time.
Can I add, just backing up what Paul's saying here, from my research, just as I'm sure Paul's come across this as well, the Prime Minister at the time, Mr. Lloyd George, was keen to keep Ireland what he called a police war.
Mm.
He didn't want to send in the army to do what armies do. But it was very noticeable that during a speech in October, November, I think it was in the Mansion House in London, where Lloyd George, in talking about Ireland, he said that the government had to reorganise the police, and now the terrorists are complaining about being terrorised.
Now, he had a thing about if you're a combatant in a war, you have to wear a uniform.
Yes. Back then, the government had realised this particular thing about combatants. And as a result of that, the government put posters up throughout the island explaining the situation of what a combatant is and isn't. I have several things here in relation. This is actually an exact copy of the poster. This starts with, notice to the IRA. Read this, and if you decide to be led astray by your leaders in the belief that you are soldiers and entitled to be treated as soldiers, you have yourself to blame. Only armed forces who fulfil certain conditions can avail of themselves of the right conferred by the laws and customs of war. These conditions are, 1, they must be commanded by a person responsible for his subordinates. 2, they must wear a fixed distinctive sign or uniform recognisable from a distance. 3, they must carry their arms openly. And 4, they must conduct their operations in accordance with the laws and customs of war. Now, that it goes on and goes on about what a soldier is or whatever. However, they say they know a man dressed in civilian clothes who tries to kill another person, whether soldier, police or civilian, is nothing more than a common murderer. There are men among you who fought in the last war. Ask them what would have happened to men dressed as civilians who suddenly shot or threw bombs at soldiers in one of the villages behind the line. They will tell you that such persons would have been shot immediately on capture and all civilized nations would have approved. Your leaders are encouraging you to do that for which any civilized nation would lawfully execute you. Do not be deceived. If you go on murdering disguised as civilians, you will, in the end, pay the penalty either fighting or on the scaffold.
Okay, so we're back to the kind of propaganda, called it that, if you will, that the Germans had come up with at the beginning in Belgium, the beginning of the First World War, where they referred to the Belgians who were attacking them as francs-tireurs, as basically terrorists.
Right.
Do you think... You've written three books on the auxiliaries. Do you think that they have got a bad press?
Yes.
Let me rephrase. Bad press is one thing. Unfair press is different. Okay. Definitely they've got a bad press.
I'll give you this. This quote, which I've found, is purported to come from a US senator by the name of Hiram Johnson in 1918. And he says, the first
very
casualty,
prominent and very well-known American senator.
The very first casualty when war comes is truth. So if something is happening that you're going to blame the other side, you blow it out of all proportion, you try and get the country on your side of the argument. And another thing which is very important is we today are looking through eyes of the 21st century, back 100 years. The time frame and the people dealing with the things going on at that time have a totally different mindset to us. So things that were normal back then aren't normal today.
Okay, but hang on a second. I mean, they were Tudor's toughs in the sense that Major General Hugh Tudor was Inspector General of the RIC. But the man who was directly responsible for them when they came to Ireland in the first place was Percy Crozier, who you would be very familiar with as somebody who led the, I think it was the 9th Rifles in
the Ulster Division,
in the Battle of the Somme. This was a tough man. This is somebody who personally shot on the 1st of July 1916, personally shot men of his own regiment who were retreating, and they had been told not to retreat. This is somebody who couldn't stomach the activities of the auxiliaries and resigned.
But that particular incident you're referring to is Trim. And the reason why there was an incident that happened in Trim, when the station was attacked and men were shot and the auxiliaries went on a bit of a rampage in the town. He arrived up at Trim and dismissed every single one of them on the spot. Now,
and they were reinstated, I think, by Tudor.
Yes, because when they got over to London, they complained to the Irish office, who then complained to Tudor, who then reinstated them. Because how would you feel if you had done nothing wrong? If you'd been one of those men and didn't get involved in the burning of the place, you were doing your normal duties, and you got dismissed, you'd have a grievance.
Well, if your commanding officer thinks you were worthy of dismissal and he personally dismisses you, you were probably up to no good.
But you've got to bear in mind there is a process of being able to dismiss people. That wasn't done. There was no right of reply. So whenever Tudor reinstated them, Crozier thought his power was being overrun, so he resigned. And you can understand his side of it too, but you've got to understand the people who were not involved being dismissed for something they didn't do. You wouldn't like it yourself.
Paul, what's your attitude to the press that the Uggsies have got over the years?
My one would be, when you take a look at the unit, I think they were extremely efficient. And I think actually Michael Collins and his group noted that they were very, very efficient throughout the country. And the IRA were actually quite worried about this. Didn't mind the DMP, RIC, the British Army, but the auxiliaries actually worried them. When the auxiliaries started off, there was a couple of mistakes made. They did take part in reprisals, correct? Especially when their men were killed or people that they knew were killed. But as the unit went on in time, it got better and better. Mm-hmm. And one of the major things in all military units is leadership. If you have a good leader who can control the men, that's fine. Some of the auxiliary units, they did not have good leadership, and that's where they fell down. As the auxiliaries went on, they set up their own intelligence section. When Bloody Sunday happened, Michael Collins killed all the British intelligence guys. The auxiliaries stepped in and they set up their own intelligence unit, and then they continued to go after IRA members throughout the whole country. So they were adapting as they went on. As I mentioned earlier on, I believe they were a special forces unit and they were learning as they went. This was one of the four special forces unit in the world at the time in the 20th century. So as they went on, they improved. And by, I'd say, May, June 1921, they were actually getting the upper hand on the IRA.
OK, now, as we've said, both the Ugsies and the Tans were formed in 1920, or they arrived in Ireland in 1920, a year which saw violence escalating between the IRA and Crown forces. It seemed like anyone was a potential target. In this clip from the RTE radio archives, Thomas Óg McCurtain recalls how his father, Thomas McCurtain, Lord Mayor of Cork, knew his life was in danger.
There's a story told by some of the old lads that he was writing in the City Hall one day, and apparently he had already got a death warning from the police. And one man came in and he said, Tomas, he said, we have a definite from the intelligence crowd. The next policeman to be shot, they'll shoot you. And he just looked up for a moment and said, very interesting, and carried on with his work.
Liz Gillis, why was McCurtain targeted?
Well, McCurtain's a high-profile target. Not only is he a commanding officer of the Cork No. 1 Brigade at that time, but he was also recently elected the Lord Mayor of Cork. And the IRA, they're increasing their attacks on the RSC because they were the front line in all of this. And a number of barracks are being attacked. You've got a number of RSC men getting killed. So it's basically tit for tat. Mm. And also you'd have to believe that if the RSC succeed in taking out a high profile target, the IRA, the leadership, then that will undermine the authority of the IRA and they'll fall apart. That didn't happen. But what happens to McCurtain is that on the 20th of March, which was actually his 36th birthday, masked men arrived, knocked at the house at night. He was upstairs in bed. His wife answers the door. They ask for McCurtain. They go upstairs. He's getting dressed and they shot him. And his wife was heavily pregnant at the time. And the warning came true.
Mm. What happened after he was killed?
Well, you have an inquest held, and inquest had been held previously, but this one is different because previous to this, you had the Cork County Council had actually given their allegiance to the Dáil, so they're in control, Sinn Féin councillors. But at this inquest, there's a verdict of willful murder brought against Lloyd George, Lord French, Act Inspector General Smith of the RIC and D.I. Swansea, just to name a few. There's a lot more people that are actually named in the shooting of McCurtain.
Now, Corkman Michael Collins takes this very personally and he makes it his business to ensure that revenge is taken on RIC officers alleged to have been involved in the assassination. And one of the most prominent, one of the names you've already mentioned there, the RIC District Inspector Oswald Swansea. So what happened to him?
Well, he's actually assassinated himself by members of the Cork IRA and also members of the Dublin Brigade. And it's in August that this happens, and this, it comes out of blue, but it's a determined attack by the Cork IRA, and it's making a statement because he's shot when he's coming out of church in Lisburn, and also he's shot with McCurtain's own gun. So they are making a statement with this assassination. Now what follows then from that is events that just get out of control very, very quickly.
There are retaliations in Lisburn.
In Lisburn, yeah. You have pogroms that start off and it's taken out on the local Catholic population. This campaign of violence is conducted by members of the UVF and it eventually leads to the establishment of the Ulster Special Constabulary, or what we'd know as the B-Specials.
And the members of, some of the members of the UVF who were wreaking havoc were actually also members of the B-Specials, it turns out. So they were patrolling or policing themselves.
Yes. As you say, them policing themselves, there was no real control or protection.
Okay. I'm going to take a quick break now, and when we return, we'll be hearing more about the retaliatory violence between the IRA and the Crown Forces, including the events surrounding the burning of Enniskillen in County Clare and the infamous burning of Cork. Stay with us.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. We're talking about the auxiliaries, the Black and Tans, and the cycle of attacks and reprisals that came to define the Irish War of Independence, the so-called Dirty War. The IRA fought a guerrilla war, essentially, against the Crown forces, using local knowledge to their advantage in ambushes. In this clip from the RTE Radio Archives, Paddy O'Dwyer from Enniskillen recalls how the IRA set up their ambush in Renin in September of 1920.
There was a false message sent to the barrack here that the barrack in Milltown was attacked. That was a trap to draw them out, you see. They wanted them to come out. In Renin, the mountains are very high there, you know, the cliffs, and they fought off at the top of the hills there and ambushed them there.
And as the IRA intensified their campaign against the RIC and the Black and Tans, they were quick to retaliate, and their reprisals often targeted the civilian population. Tomás, briefly explain what happened at Rainin and what were the consequences of that ambush?
Sure. Well, it's the first point I think to make about Rainin is, in some sense, it could be seen as a reprisal in itself, because on the morning of the ambush, Ignatius O'Neill, who commanded the ambush, said to his men, "Today, soldiers of the Republic, we avenge the death of Martin." And he's referring to Martin Devitt, who in February of 1920 had been killed in a fight, in a gunfight with the RIC at Crow's Bridge outside of Ennistymon. So there is this inescapable tit-for-tat nature, obviously, of the conflict. But in terms of the Rainin ambush, there had been several attempts prior to that by the 4th Battalion of the Midclare Brigade to launch attacks on the British forces in the area. But it had been seen in August that a convoy of Black and Tans had been moving between Ennistymon and Milton Malbay, and they decided to launch the attack, and as Paddy says there, in a point in the road that's actually very appropriate for an ambush. It's elevated, it's at the bend of a road, so the actual any vehicle would have to slow down at that point. It's executed by 60 members of the 4th Battalion. 7 companies of that battalion participate. Only 5 riflemen lead the charge. There's a limited number of weapons. But in a broader sense, 6 members of that force are killed. 5 of them are Irish men. One of them is a Black and Tan. 6 of them are killed. One of them escapes the immediate fire and is chased down and shot dead by 2 volunteers. But at the same time, entirely coincidentally, in Dunbeg, further into West Clare, Captain Alan Lindrum, who was the acting magistrate, a former British officer himself, was confronted and held up by members of the IRA in Dunbeg. It seems he put his hand down to the handbrake, which was interpreted by the IRA holding him up as picking up a gun. He's shot and he's killed. The 2nd Royal Scots, who were based in Ennistymon, hear about this incident. They're making their way from Ennistymon to West Clare and Dunbeg, and as they turn the corner in Rainin, they encountered the immediate aftermath of the Rainin ambush. The IRA are actually there taking the weapons from the RIC and Black and Tans who had been killed. So there's an immediate rearguard action, which is a significant, because there's 3 lorries of British soldiers with automatic weaponry on board. The rearguard is fought, no IRA man is killed, and that adds, in terms of the memory of the event, that adds another dimension to it. But what's really significant, I suppose, in terms of reprisals, is that night in the towns of Ennistymon, Lahinch and Milton Malbay, those towns closest to the site of the ambush, are attacked by members of the British forces, including the regular British Army, 2nd Royal Scots, Black and Tans and RIC, who burn large portions of those towns. 6 people are killed, 5 of them are civilians with nothing to do with the IRA. One of them is an IRA volunteer who was actually involved in the ambush. His father is also one of the others who's killed outside of Lahinch that night. So 6 people are killed. And just to make the point, 12 people now, you know, in 24 hours, 12 people are killed in an area of 2.7 miles. And that is a significant escalation by anyone's measure.
And if anybody is surprised to hear you talking about an Irishman in the Black and Tans, I think something like 10% of the Black and Tan force were actually Irish.
They were, but there is a point to be made, I think, in relation to that, Miles. I mean, the conflict is dichotomous. We need to be able to separate out the different forces that are involved. But I think sometimes that's played on a little bit too much, to be honest. I mean, it's a dichotomous conflict. It is the Irish Republican Army and Republican supporters against British rule in Ireland and anybody attached to that British rule. So there are, of course, Irishmen who are on that other side. Yeah. But in the context of that conflict or that insurgency, they're agents of British rule.
We're going to hear a little bit more about the attack on Ennistymon from the RTE archives and Paddy O'Dwyer, who was an eyewitness to the burning of the town. He describes here what happened to Tom Canole, a local union leader who British forces claimed was involved in the ambush.
3 of the soldiers sent the wife up the Powen Road, and she had this child in her arms. They took the husband, they dragged him down as far as where the cross is now, and they shot him there. And he was dying at the time, in a dying condition. The house was in flames at the time. And one of the officers said, "Take him up now," he says, "take him up now, drag him up and throw him into the flames," he says. One of the soldiers refused to carry him. He'd been a Catholic. He said, "No, sir," he says, "until the man is dead. And when he's dead," he says, "I'll comply with your order." At any rate, the other 3 and the officer dragged him up. And the heat was so bad that the officer caught him in his arms, and he only went halfway and flung him in through the doorway into the flames. And the house was burning mad.
And that account is from Paddy O'Dwyer speaking in an RTE radio documentary first broadcast in 1985. The most people tend to talk about the events in Cork, Dublin, Tipperary, Kerry in the War of Independence, but the Clare IRA, East Clare IRA in particular, I think, played an enormous part. And there were some major successes against the Crown forces, but also losses, most famously at Killaloe Bridge. And we'll hear a little bit in just a few minutes from one of the commanding officers of the IRA in East Clare, Michael Brennan, on what happened at Killaloe Bridge. But what's the background to the murders at Killaloe Bridge?
Yeah, it's really interesting because the Rinnean ambush happens on the 22nd of September, but 4 days before that in Scariff in East Clare, the East Clare IRA attacked the RIC barracks in Scariff. Now, that is the most heavily fortified RIC barracks remaining in North East Clare, because from spring of 1919, all of the outlying barracks had been attacked and had been evacuated. So the decision was made to attack the RIC barracks. It escalates the insurgency in that area fairly dramatically. Nobody is killed, but it still is a significant attack. In the days afterwards, the RIC evacuate the barracks in Scariff and move to Killaloe. And this means that from East Galway through to Killaloe over to Tulla, you know, an area of about 15 miles, there's no regular RIC or police presence. So that's hugely significant. But there's an escalation miles from that moment on, because the Rinnean ambush happens in the Midclare Brigade area 4 days later. I think that actually motivates Brennan. It's one of my theories. I think Brennan sees that happening in Midclare. Clear. There's a tension between the brigades and the Brennans and the Barretts for years at that point, because we see on the 25th of September, Brennan assembles a group of men between 18 and 20 who go into Broadford, attack the RIC on the street of Broadford, shoot Constable Michael Brogan dead. 4 days later, they go to O'Brien's Bridge, go into a public house, shoot Constable Downey and O'Keefe in that public house. On the 6th of October, a week later, the Fecal IRA attack the RIC in Fecal, and Sergeant Doherty and Constable Stanley are killed there. We see an alleged informer on the 26th of October in the same month also executed by the Fecal IRA. And then we see the auxiliaries arrive in days later into Killaloe. They immediately gather intelligence, because on the 16th of November, they make their way down on the SS steamer. The first time they've employed that route, normally they go by road. The IRA had their signals to counteract that. But they take the SS steamer, they go on Loch Derg, they arrive outside Williamstown House, where three IRA volunteers, Rogers, McMahon and Gilday, who had been involved in some of these incidents, are being sheltered. Michael Egan, the caretaker, is confronted. He says they're not there. They go in, they find the three volunteers, they take the three, including Michael Egan, on the SS steamer back to Killaloe, including two Conway brothers who were brought as well. They're tortured, interrogated, tortured, and at 11 o'clock, somewhere between 11 and 11:30, they're handed over from the auxiliaries to the RIC and Black and Tan Force, who are based in Killaloe on the Clare side of the bridge. And as they're being brought across that bridge, they're shot dead.
Yeah, we'll actually hear a little bit from Michael Brennan. Now, he wasn't present, obviously, but he had taken part in that attack on the RIC in O'Brien's Bridge late in 1920, personally shot, according to his own witness statement, two policemen dead in a public house there. During that engagement, he was wounded. He was out of commission for a number of weeks with a broken arm. While he was hiding in Ennis Mental Hospital, the auxiliaries took their own revenge for the O'Brien's Bridge raid and the Scariff raid at Killaloe Bridge.
On November 16th, three of the men who were with me when I was wounded were murdered by auxiliaries on the bridge at Killaloe. This auxiliary company had recently occupied the Lakeside Hotel on the Tipperary side of Loch Derg, just across from Killaloe. They had gone up the lake in a boat and surprised the men in a house near Mount Shannon on the edge of the lake. They took the prisoners to the Lakeside Hotel and next night took them out on Killaloe Bridge with their hands tied behind their backs and riddled them with bullets. The British issued a statement that the four men were shot trying to escape, though their hands were still tied behind their backs when the bodies were found.
The words there of Michael Brennan of the East Clare IRA. Now, he goes on to become an important figure nationally, Michael Brennan, doesn't he?
Yeah, he becomes the chief of staff subsequently. I mean, I suppose, first of all, in the Civil War, he becomes really significant because west of the Shannon, he's the more senior IRA figure who takes the Free State side. And almost the entire East Clare IRA brigade go with him one would have to suggest, out of loyalty to him, and there was a tremendous loyalty to him personally as much as any ideological position, but he takes that, he holds Limerick and he plays a really important role for the Free State west of the Shannon. But he goes on then subsequently to become chief of staff of the Irish Army itself for a period of 10 years. But just to make one point, going back on Brennan, and as you say, he's involved in the attack on the O'Brien's Bridge public house. On either side of him is Michael McMahon and Alfie Rogers. Behind him is Martin Gilday. And they're the three men who were subsequently captured by the auxiliaries. So these men are directly involved in physical force activity. And this is the nature of the insurgency at the time. But it is important to connect up those stories directly in terms of the men's involvement and their subsequent capture and murder on the bridge.
Now, we're talking about atrocities. We're talking about atrocities committed by the Crown Forces. In a subsequent programme, we will talk about atrocities committed by the IRA. But Liz, one particularly horrific account which you came across in the military archives, and it concerns the brutal murders of the young Lochnan brothers in County Galway. What happened to them?
Well, what happened to them was it was brutal, it was horrific, and I actually discovered this years ago from military archives and I actually couldn't believe what I was reading. They were members of the IRA in Galway and they were arrested at their family home, the family farm in Shanaglish, and on the 22nd of November. So this sort of ties in with what Tomás was saying about the escalation of violence in that part of the country. They'd been involved in certain engagements, but they're arrested by D Company of the Auxies, who had been based in Galway, and they're taken to Drumharsna Castle, and they're tortured, they're interrogated, and they're murdered shortly after in Maya Hines Wood. Now, the family, their mother, their sister, they were asking about them because no one heard anything about their whereabouts. A couple of days later, the auxiliaries arrive saying that the brothers had escaped from the castle, but they were going to get them. They wanted them. So basically, if you get them before we do, you know, make sure they stay running. But by that stage, they were actually dead. Now, a couple more days past, the sister is relentless. She goes from barracks to barracks to try and find out. She just hits stonewall after stonewall. Then on the 5th of December, you have their cousin, Michael, who discovers the bodies in a pond, and it's just horrific.
Mm. And the Department of Defence's military archives holds a copy of a statement made by their mother, Kate, and the sister you were talking about, Nora. I should warn you, as you might expect, the statement does not make for pleasant listening.
The sister Nora, on hearing of the discovery, went to Kinvara and recognised the bodies of her brothers. They were hideously mutilated. They were naked. Not a particle of clothing remained, save one of Harry's boots. His body was very much charred and was all scars and gashes. His right arm was badly injured, being almost severed from the body. The lips, teeth, nose and one eye and a part of his forehead remained. The chin and the back portion of the head were torn away. Patrick's body was not quite so much charred. His back and shoulders remained intact, but on his limbs were deep gashes, while decorations in the form of diamond-shaped carving were cut along his ribs and chest. His face was entirely bashed away.
So it's an absolutely heart-wrenching account from the mother and the sister of the two Lochnans. There are also photos of the brothers' bodies. I've seen them myself. You pointed them out to me. I wouldn't recommend anybody to look at them, but you have.
Yeah, because again, you're reading the statement and you're thinking, hang on a minute, this can't be, it can't be true. Because the conflict, it was a propaganda war as well as being a military conflict. And Collins is brilliant at propaganda. And you have, in July 1920, the arrest and torture of Tom Hales and Pat Hart. And Tom Hales actually wrote his accounts of what happened to him, and that was published for America. So you can see propaganda, the value of this. And you're thinking, well, could this be propaganda? But then you see the photographs. And before the boys were buried, the family insisted that photographs were taken. And it's not people that you're looking at. You would actually think, this is not a person that is in this coffin. Mm. It cannot be denied what happened to those boys.
1920 then drew to a close with one of the most infamous reprisals carried out by the Auxies, the burning of Cork City on the 11th of December. This was in response to the IRA ambush at Dillon's Cross earlier that day. And this is the voice from the RTE radio archives of an unnamed civilian who witnessed this event.
About 7:30 or so that night, I was sitting down to tea with the rest of the family, and suddenly we were all brought to our feet by the sound of a grenade exploding somewhere outside, followed soon afterwards by two further explosions. Then, after a silence, there was shouting and shots, revolvers and rifle shots being fired outside. I ran upstairs to the bedroom window, and by the light of the gas lamp across the way and a public house, I saw a scattered body of auxiliaries racing down the road, shouting and shooting for all they were worth. This went on for quite a while until somebody took charge of them and got them into some sort of order and started a house-to-house search.
Paul, what had happened at Dillon's Cross that led to the auxiliaries going on the rampage in Cork City that night?
Cork Brigade of the IRA, they planned, they wanted to hit up the auxiliaries, and they'd been planning this for a number of weeks.
This wasn't long after the Kilmichael ambush either.
No, it's a little bit after, but not that much. And the Kilmichael ambush actually kind of proved that the auxiliaries, they weren't the super soldiers that everybody thought they were. And at Dillon's Cross, it was touch and go with the ambush. Were the auxiliaries going to come out? Were they not? And on the night in particular, they did come out. Grenade and pistol fire was opened up on them. One auxiliary was killed and 12 were wounded in that. Once again, this is this guerrilla warfare that we talked about earlier on. No uniforms. The IRA disappeared into the night, leaving the auxiliaries dead and wounded on the street. This greatly frustrated the auxiliary division of the RIC, made them very angry. And as we mentioned before, leadership kind of broke down and a reprisal took place on Cork City, because the IRA were Cork Brigade IRA at that time. And with the Black and Tans, the auxiliaries, British military, they decided to take it out on the city.
And that night, the auxiliaries and the Tans in particular went to Patrick Street, Cork City's main thoroughfare, and proceeded to set fire to most of the street. In this clip from the RTE archives, a post office worker describes the devastation he witnessed.
I was on duty the night of the fire in the GPO. I came off duty about 11 o'clock, walked up Winthrop Street and came onto Patrick Street, which was covered in water flowing everywhere, and firemen rushing all over the place with hoses to try and stop the fire. The fire was raging then. There were a few scattered people about, that was all though. But black and tans everywhere, and they're racing about, and they're looting the shops. Well, they were darting in and out of houses about, and as far as I saw, they were ripping the hoses, because water was flowing everywhere about, and the firemen was doing the best they could against all kinds of odds.
Ernest, what does your research tell you about the burning of the city of Cork?
Well, K Company have been blamed, as K Company of the auxiliaries, have been blamed for it, rightly or wrongly. There's obviously a very fluid situation, but as far as the auxiliaries are concerned, the incident begins at 7:30 whenever the patrol is ambushed at Dillon's Cross. And the officer in charge of the ambush, Piers de Havilland, stated at the Court of Inquiry in relation to the Cork fires that, and I quote, he saw the glare of burning houses within 5 minutes of the ambush. It was quite impossible for any of the auxiliaries to have done this as a result of this ambush. It is my own impression that it was prearranged by the Shinners to start the fire after the ambush. But I'll go on. My further research has been obviously the one in regards to section leader Charles Schultz of K Company, where his letter home was intercepted by the IRA claiming that he had been part and parcel of the fire. However, you've got to look at it in an overall context. I've come across in my research a report from the owner of Flanagan's Hotel in Cork, had contacted the CEO of K Company, stating that he would give evidence to the effect that had it not been for the auxiliaries, his hotel would have went on fire. So there's that one on the other side. However, General Tudor, or Inspector General Tudor, did a report, not a full report, but he comes across some of the stuff within the report, which I find interesting. K Company were marched out of the barracks at 10 p.m. by their senior officer, i.e. First Class District Inspector Colonel Latimer, and he had 55 men walk out with him, and 30 minutes after the first fire started at 9:30. However, that's a bit contradictory with Piers de Havilland's report at 7:30, 7:35. So there's a bit contradictory there. However, Tudor goes on to say that he could not disprove that some members of K Company were involved. However, he said any evidence he finds he will forward to the inquiry. But I also find There's a further report attached to this supplementary report from a district inspector, Dagan, and he added, the first platoon of K Company arrived in Cork on the 2nd of December, the last platoon on the 8th of December. And he further states that he asked one witness who talked about the black and tans and the auxiliaries and how he distinguished between these, and he said by uniform only. There is a large number of uniforms in possession of ex-soldiers and Sinn Féiners in Cork. And his point is, he says, that unless the individuals are recognised, uniform is not sufficient proof. I understand that there were 2,433 soldiers in Cork on the night of the fires, and this appears ample to prevent Cork from burning, but they weren't used. He further goes on to say, my opinion is that K Company could not possibly have been in a position to pick out particular houses to burn, as they had only been in Cork a few days. Colonel Latimer seems to have done his best to control and account for his men. I think it is possible that some odd members of K Company were implicated in the burnings. There is no proof as to individuals, and therefore, legally, it is impossible to bring charges home. There is no evidence to show that more than one soldier was implicated, and he was a soldier in a kilt. And the DI, Colonel Latimer, in the same report stated that the case was already prejudged by the action of the military authorities in clearing the police off the street at 3 a.m. in the morning. That is when all the looting started to happen. And it didn't support his argument whenever the military authorities moved K Company out of Cork the following day.
I would contest, Ernest, some of your points made there. Okay. In terms of intelligence, you know, you were suggesting that K Company couldn't have known, you know, or had the information. But, you know, they only relied on people who had information, and that was very easy to navigate your way around the city and burn it.
Yes, people who knew where to go. Would agree with you to some degree, because from my research on it, if they're going to a particular area where the driver doesn't know his way around, sure, they're going to have a local guide. That's a local RIC man who would be able to tell them where such and such is, what street day is, whatever, they guide them around. And no doubt they probably did have them out with them. But I'm just going by what the supplementary reports are saying. And I think the district inspector who talked about the identification of people, just because a man's wearing a uniform, unless you personally identify that person as the person who's committed it, then it's very hard to prove legally they were the ones that sent fire to the place.
Sure. I think at the same time, you know, there can be logic implied at times when you're looking at the behaviour across the whole of 1920. You know, in Fecal in East Clare after the ambush that I mentioned earlier on in the programme, you know, an RIC sergeant called John McFadden guided the Black and Tans across the whole area of Fecal, a rural area, and ensured that a significant number of houses were burnt. The same thing happened in an assignment to a different degree. But when you look at the reports of the district inspectors, the relevant district inspectors, they talk about unknown men, strange men that come into an area. So some of those reports, again, you know, have to be treated with huge caution
agree with you. That's why I've often said that, you know, we can talk to the cows come home about this. We weren't there. We can only go by what we see 100 years later.
Sure. I just want to make the further point, though, in relation to the reprisals that we've been talking about. I mean, I think it does tap into a policy that was there, an unofficial policy. And I think, again, using logic, given the nature of the insurgency, I think it's entirely logical that the British would employ those methods. And they're against the rules that, you know, you were quoting earlier on.
The rules of war.
But they're against them, you know. That I think if they try and encourage the IRA to adapt conventional warfare rules, but don't employ them themselves, if there's an issue.
There's always two sides to every coin. Sure. But the British did do their best to try and get the IRA to confer to the rules of war. But obviously it suited the IRA to play the way they did.
But at the same time, they didn't recognise it as a war. So
they recognise it as a police war, not as a conventional war.
But they're encouraging the IRA to adapt the rules of war,
but they are the ones. This is the where the problems all arise, because everybody has their own view, version, or whatever. And as I say, we have to try and sort it out from what records are left.
Okay. Now we've already heard briefly. We talk about Kilmichael in an entirely different programme. But Paul, you were making the point that Kilmichael demonstrated that the Uggsies were not supermen. Another episode demonstrates that the auxiliaries could actually be infiltrated. Liz, tell us about John Reynolds.
Yeah, he's actually a really interesting character, and he was a member of F Company based in Dublin. But he was actually
now he's a member of the Auxiliaries F Company, because yeah. there's an IRA F Company in Dublin as well.
Yeah, there's many IRA F companies.
He's also an Englishman.
He's also an Englishman, sorry.
Yes, yeah. But he was actually ended up working for Collins, and how that comes about is because through one of the many women involved with coming him on, Breed Foley, her husband had been arrested. Now, he's a member of Sinn Féin, but who he was arrested by was Captain King. At that particular arrest, Reynolds is there. And Foley, obviously, she was worried about her husband, what was going to happen. He's been brought to Dublin Castle. A lot of people have been beaten and tortured in Dublin Castle. But Reynolds said, look, he'd be all right. He'd make sure he'd be all right. And he actually remained true to his word. So when she goes and finds out her husband is actually all right, she got him a couple of cigarettes. She talks to him. Then she discovers, well, maybe he could work for us. And she goes to Collins and he says, well, suss him out. And she did. And he did. He becomes an agent and he provides a lot of information on his comrades, members of F Company that were in Dublin Castle. So he's working for both sides.
Does he get away with it?
No. He gets away for a while. Now, they were suspicious, is that the authorities, his superiors were suspicious that he was up to something. And he is transferred to County Clare. And while he's there, he continues to work for the IRA. But then he is discovered and he's arrested and he's brought back up to Burgers Bush. And I think really only for the truce came into effect, he would have been executed for his activities. But it doesn't stop there with him, because then he joined the National Army in the Civil War. He's based down in Renmore, County Galway. So he's National Army, he's pro-treaty, but his loyalties begin to wane. And he decides that he'll throw in his lot with the anti-treaty IRA, and he starts providing them with guns and so on. So he's back up to his usual tricks that he was in the War of Independence.
Ernest, what's your take on Reynolds?
I think Liz has covered it very well. Reynolds was an individual that I'm sure the auxiliaries didn't have their doubts about. And when he went off to G Company in Clare, he was actually promoted. Would you believe? He was actually promoted. So you have to question yourself, do they have the full facts on him? But they actually arrest him when he's out on patrol with the IRA. And that's when he gets caught, you know, because his own unit, what are you doing out with them? Come with us. And he ends up back in Burger Bush. And as Liz says, if it hadn't been for the truce, he'd have been swinging.
Yeah, same is true of Ned Broy, for example. Yep. We'll talk about Ned Broy in a separate programme. Now, the War of Independence effectively ends with the truce in July 1921, after which negotiations began between the British and Irish governments. And this led to the signing, ultimately, of the Anglo-Irish Treaty in December 1921. 26 counties of Ireland would become a free state. The British forces would leave. We'll hear once again from Paddy O'Dwyer. In February 1922, he witnessed the Crown forces carry out one last act of violence before they left.
There was about 200 or 300 people standing opposite the barrack, and I was sitting on the sill of the window, and this man, a tall tan, came out, a man named Swain, and there was a big crowd in front of me. He shouted, "Get away, you bloody Irish, get away," he says. So when the crowd then wouldn't move, when he saw that they weren't going to go, he pulled out the revolver and he fired 3 shots into the crowd. And I saw one woman fall, drop in front of me. And 5 minutes after, the bomb came.
Tomás, how did all of this come about?
Yeah, well, as Paddy explains it there was a large assembly of people arrived to see the British forces off from Innistimon. You know, obviously everybody knew the significance of it. But tension developed quite quickly. And in addition to what Paddy suggests was being shouted, Upranin was one of the shouts that came from the crowd several times. So Upranin and up the IRA. So that was clearly causing tension within the British forces. But as suggested there, hand grenades are thrown into the crowd, very reckless, and a number of people are very seriously wounded. And I remember we mentioned Nora Canavan at the outset of the programme. She was 14 now when that happens. And she lived just outside of Innistimon on the way to Innis. So that convoy, after that incident, passed her home. And she remembered sitting outside her house watching them pass. And again, her whole countenance, her breathing, you could feel it lift off of her when she actually recalled at the age of 103, 104, watching that convoy of British forces departing her road, which they had passed daily, you know, for over 2 years. And she knew they were leaving for the last time. And that really gave me a sense of the relief for people, and for people who weren't necessarily connected to the conflict, the sense of relief that it's over in that sense. But it was a final parting shot. And there was another individual killed on the same day, another civilian shot during the same departure as well. So it certainly was a bitter end to that period in Clare.
Paul, who forced who to the negotiating table, as far as you're concerned? We'll get Ernest's take on a minute, because I'm hoping it might be different to yours.
I believe the Customs House raid was the last throw of the dice, really, from the IRA, and it actually worked because it gave them a huge amount of publicity and really, really put Ireland on the map. And I think that that worked. I think the IRA, they had their backs against the wall, really, with the auxiliaries, blackened hands, regular RSA, and the increased military presence in Ireland. I think the IRA were under increased pressure. Areas were being locked down throughout the whole country, and it was getting harder for the IRA to operate. There was also this serious lack of arms and ammunition. So that really affected IRA operations in the country. The Customs House, it did work, and I think what was destroyed, the British government were forced in a negotiating table over that.
Ernest, would you agree?
To a certain degree. The plain answer is yes, they did force them to the negotiating table. Because if you got to bear in mind, when you bring in a new unit from the start, it takes time to build up an accurate picture of your enemy, who the players are, where they're operating from, and so on. So eventually, all that information, when the auxiliaries are out doing their searching and their arrests, all that information is being passed back to the Intelligence Department in Dublin Castle, which is also being passed to the Central Raids Bureau in Dublin Castle, who are targeting people, addresses, to raid. When you go and do more searches at those particular targets, you glean more arrests, more information, more intelligence, and that goes back into the system again, and it picks you out more targets. So they're picking out the right people who to raid and who to arrest. Now, the Customs House, as far as I can see, was a spectacular failure. Yes, they did succeed in burning the building, but buildings can be replaced. The information can be replaced. But the problem was the IRA lost 100-odd men arrested that day. Could they replace that manpower? Not to the same extent that Britain could place the manpower it was losing. I mean, we talk about Kilmichael being a major success for the IRA. Yes, it was. But in the annals of British history, It's a footnote. Hmm. So they had always manpower coming in.
Yeah, but in the annals of British history, any individual engagement in the War of Independence is a footnote.
Yes, and honestly it is. But however, with the numerous amount of IRA men in prison and internment camps and in their early graves because of their fight with the auxiliaries, the IRA at that time was a spent force. Because Collins himself has even said that we had 3 weeks of ammunition left. So the constant arrests, searches and operations against the IRA meant that they were having problems in recruiting, no doubt about that, because they were afraid of the informant who would have passed information to the auxiliaries or to the RIC, and IRA men going out on operations would be very careful of who they were with, because they didn't want to get arrested or get shot. So it did help. Now, whenever the truce was called, General Strickland, who was in charge down in Munster, was livid. Field Marshal Wilson was also livid, because Lloyd George was bound to political pressure. These two senior officers in the army knew that the IRA were about to collapse and they wanted to finish it. But the politicians said, no, we're going for the truce.
Liz, what's your take?
I wouldn't agree with that. I think both sides were calling each other's bluff. In terms of arms and ammunition, that was always a problem for the IRA. In terms of the IRA Dublin Brigade, the IRA being smashed after the burning of the Custom House, no, I certainly don't agree with that, because the record showed there were over 4,000 full-time and part-time volunteers that were still available for service. But in terms of what Churchill was planning, like, remember, it's not just a physical campaign, this is a propaganda campaign, and the British government were losing support at home. And what Churchill was planning to do to crush the IRA, obviously bring in the army, so actually recognise it, that this is a war, it's not a police action anymore, it's a war. But this whole country was going to become a police state. that you're going to have boxes, like search boxes everywhere, barbed wire. He actually had a plan to have, in effect, concentration camps set up to put women and children and civilians in so then they could aerial bomb parts of the country. Now, to me, that doesn't sound like a side that's winning. So both sides are...
Sounds like a side that's determined to keep going, though.
And that's the whole thing, though. But one side had to crush the other. The other side only had to exist.
Okay, I want to get Tomás's take, but I think Ernest wants to come back in briefly before
just,
we finish.
Just one last thing. Before the truce, Tudor sent out a report to all the RIC divisions, including the Auxiliary Division, in relation to the sending of the truce. And this is what he actually written. It is fully recognised by the government that the relentless pressure exercised by the police on the rebels during the last 12 months is the main factor that has brought about these negotiations. And that was sent out on the 11th of the 7th, 1921.
Tomás, your take.
Yeah, again, I mean, I've read reports, you know, throughout the whole period saying from district inspectors, from Inspector General of the RIC, again claiming that the IRA has spent force. This is in early 1920, that, you know, people had been intimidated and that's no longer the case, etc. But it didn't turn out to be the case. So again, what is stated by somebody on one side of the conflict, on both sides, obviously, it doesn't always necessarily relate to the reality of it. I do think one thing we haven't mentioned is the kind of internationalization of the propaganda, which is really significant in terms of Britain and their decisions, particularly the reprisals. You know, the effect that that has at an international level is hugely significant in terms of what decisions Britain take in relation to the conflict. I think, OK, the IRA were under severe pressure, but they had been throughout the whole war. By the middle of 1921, they had more intelligence than they ever had. You know, they had more experience than they ever had. So in many ways, they were in a good position to continue the war if they so choose. Now, your point, I think, Ernest, is well made in terms of the constant reinforcement options of the British forces. But I do think, given the dynamic of it, the internationalisation of the propaganda, the British were under as much pressure because of the way in which the IRA executed the war and the support levels that they got throughout the country brought them to the table.
That's unfortunately all we've got time for. We're going to have to leave it there. My thanks tonight to all my guests, Tomás McNamara, Ernest McCall, Paul O'Brien and Liz Gillis. Join us next week. We'll be continuing our series on the War of Independence. You can find extended podcasts on the series on our website, rte.ie/history. Our readers tonight were Cathy Rose O'Brien and Daniel Costello. My thanks tonight to Mark McGrath on sound and, as always, to our colleagues in the Military Archives for their assistance as well. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, for me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.